Translation. By penance only can one even approach the personality of Godhead, who is within the heart of every living entity and at the same time beyond the reach of all senses. Translation responsively. By penance only can one even approach the personality of Godhead.
By penance only can one even approach the personality of Godhead.
Who is within the heart of every living entity.
Who is within the heart of every living entity.
And at the same time,
beyond the reach of all
senses. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Rudra was advised by Brahma to perform penance as an example to his sons and follow that penance and followers that, sorry, to his sons and followers. That penance is necessary for attaining the favor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In Bhagavad Gita, it is said that the common mass of people follow the path shown by any authority. Thus, Brahma, disgusted with the Rudra generations and afraid of being devoured by the increasing population, asked Rudra to stop producing such unwanted generation and take to penance for attaining the favour of the Supreme Lord. We find, therefore, in pictures that Rudra is always sitting in meditation for the attainment of the favour of the Lord. Indirectly, the sons and followers of Rudra are advised to stop the business of annihilation, following the Rudra principle while the peaceful creation of Brahma is going on.
Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasati Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Sahibatale Shri Vidayanada Vasamayitana
Satapasya. Austerity is the way to Krishna. Sounds pretty tough, but that's from what this verse is saying, that actually tapasseva means that that's the only way to get to Krishna. We have to perform some tapasya, some austerity. So just recently I finished the Bhagavad Gita, reading the Bhagavad Gita. We can keep on reading Bhagavad Gita and over and over and over again. There's always new and delectable things to learn from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita. So in the last chapters, these really interesting chapters of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita, the last one is Krishna explains in 1864 that this confidential knowledge may not be explained to those who are not austere or devoted or engaged in devotional service, nor to one who is envious of me. So if someone is not practicing some sort of austerity, Krishna says that he's not accessible to that person. And then later in Bhagavad Gita, this is really the interesting part. Later in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Shradavan anuyushyascha shnuyad apiyur nara sopi mukta subhalokam praptanuya punya karma. And the translation is, and one who listens with faith without envy becomes free from sinful reactions and attains to the planet of the pious. Now the interesting part in this is that Prabhupada says in the purport, and I wanted to read that purport, because it's interesting in this connection of this verse. In the 67th verse, which is the one we just read, the Lord explicitly forbade the Gita to be spoken to those who are envious of the Lord. In other words, Bhagavad Gita is for the devotees only. But it so happens that sometimes the devotee of the Lord will hold an open class. And in that class, all the students are not expected to be devotees. So we do outreach programs and we preach. This is Prabhupada saying it's okay to go and preach to the broader community. Why do such people hold open classes? So Prabhupada is asking, why do we as devotees just spread Krishna consciousness and speak Krishna consciousness everywhere? It is explained here that although everyone is not a devotee, still there are men who are not envious, men and women who are not envious of Krishna. They have faith in him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If such persons hear from a bona fide devotee of the Lord, the result is that they become at once free from all sinful reactions and after attaining to the planetary systems where all righteous persons are situated. So even if we are in the process of preaching and presenting Krishna consciousness, If there's someone in the audience that's actually responsive, that actually has a feeling and a love for Krishna, or a love for God even, just a broad understanding of God, there's benefit for them, to the extent that Prabhupada says that they become at once free from sinful reactions, and after that attain the planetary system where all the righteous persons are situated. So therefore, simply by hearing Bhagavad Gita, even a person who does not try to become a pure devotee attains the result of righteous activities. Thus a pure devotee of the Lord gives everyone a chance to become free from all sinful reactions and to become a devotee of the Lord. So this is how wonderful it is in Krishna consciousness. Even by just spreading Krishna consciousness out there, if a person picks it up in an unenvious way, they are actually so benefited. Generally, those who are free from sinful reactions are righteous. Such persons easily take to Krishna consciousness. The word punya karmanam is very significant here. This refers to the performance of great sacrifice. Those who are righteous and performing devotional service, but who are not pure, can attain the planetary system of the pole star. Haribol, where are you going? Of the pole star, or Dhruva Loka, where Dhruva Maharaj is presiding. He is a great devotee of the Lord, and he has a special planet which is called the pole star. So even a little sacrifice, even sitting in a class and hearing about Krishna consciousness, has the greatest benefit for the living entity. The reason why I wanted to mention this is because during the week also it was my father's birthday. And of course, when a relative that has passed away, you start thinking about them and their life and how they had an association with you. So it was interesting in this regard as far as my father was concerned, because in the initial stages, he was quite disturbed about Bhakti and I becoming devotees, as a lot of people were in the 70s. It was quite a shocking thing for your young son or daughter to join the Hare Krishna movement, renounce everything and join this so-called cult. So my father was a little upset in the early days, to the extent that he used to cry. I never saw my father cry, but he would cry because of the fact that I became a devotee. I said to him, "Dad, I'm not taking any more drugs, I'm not fornicating, I'm not, you know, I'm now following some principles. I mean, isn't that what you want me to do?" But anyway, over a period of time, he slowly started to understand Krishna consciousness. He was receptive. You know, a devotee can't help but preach, and in the early days we were a bit strident in our preaching. And, you know, well, if you don't take the Krishna consciousness, you know you're going to go to hell, don't you? You know, so that sort of turned them off a little bit. After a couple of years, we refined our preaching a little bit, and we were able to actually just make them understand about Krishna consciousness and how this is actually necessary for the human form of life, that you're not this material body, and that we're progressing in Krishna consciousness is the best thing for a person to do. So slowly over a period of time, he started to appreciate this philosophy. And not that he would ever become a Hare Krishna devotee in that lifetime, but he was sincere and he performed some austerity in that he listened to me and we, you know, established a rapport to the end. At the end of his life, just before he passed away, he turned to me and he said, "I never thought that my own son would be my spiritual teacher, would be my guru, would be my teacher." This was a profound thing for him. So this man was still a meat eater. He was still, you know, following a different religious tradition. "Hari Bol, you're walking around again, are you? You want to come and sit here?" So anyway, he became interested in Krishna consciousness. And he could understand that, you know, yes, there is a supreme and our duty is to serve him. The reason why I'm mentioning this is that when he eventually did pass away, a very mystical and quite Hari Gopuram, and a quite an esoteric sort of thing happened to me, which sort of validates the things that Prabhupada is saying in this purport. He passed away at night time, and Bhakti and I went and gave him a garland and offered Ganges water and did everything as best we could to make him comfortable, not letting the other relatives see that what we were doing, because we were still in the bad books to a certain extent, you know, with our funny religion, Hare Krishna religion. So anyway, we did that. And even though we wasn't sure if he was passing away that night or not. And so Bhakti and I just went home, and he was just near the end. And in the middle of the night, in a half sort of dream wake state, I woke up. And this has never happened to me before. I mean, I'm not one for esoteric sort of things or seeing ghosts or anything like that. I'm just not into it, you know. I mean, it's just not me. But there at the end of my bed was my father, in a very ethereal sort of form. And he was young. He looked young. He wasn't like an 87-year-old man. He was now a youngest-looking father. He was dressed in white. And he spoke to me as if I'm at the bed there, and he raised his hands and he said in Dutch, "I'm free. I'm free." And then he's gone. And I knew from that experience that he was safe. The Prabhupada and the Vedas had actually helped to relieve the suffering of this person. I'm thinking, where has he gone? Where would he have gone? And this is validated in the Bhagavad Gita here, that those people that we preach to, that show some sincerity, some sort of connection, and some simple understanding, actually Krishna awards them this opportunity to go to the abode where all the saintly people are, and then wait and perform different tapasyas there, and then have an opportunity to again become a devotee. So every birthday, Bhakti and I think, where would he be now? Wow, that was nearly, how long, Bhakti? 12 years ago or something? He'd be a 12-year-old boy, you know, somewhere, a 12-year-old girl somewhere, you know, and a devotee in some temple somewhere perhaps, you know. So it's really interesting. Those sort of things are there. So to know the signs of Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada is pointing out here, one must be austere, which means you have to be submissive. You have to actually listen to someone. You have to get guidance from someone, and then you have to follow those instructions. Being submissive is very important. Austerity in Krishna consciousness means to give up all illicit activities. Very difficult to do. You know, I mean, the austerities of the past, they were relatively easy. You know, like the yogis of the past would sit in a ring of fire and meditate on the Supreme Lord, being totally absorbed in this fire, not being affected by heat, and just sit there for days on end. Or, you know, you had the austerity of going to the Himalayas and living in a cave, no little gas heater or no little blow heater or anything, just sitting there with a loincloth on and meditating. You know, I mean, that's not that difficult. But we have a really difficult austerity to perform. You know, the ones we have to perform is no meat eating, no illicit sex, no gambling, and no intoxication. Man, that's hard to do. But this is what we need in this Kali Yuga, because we're not very good at austerity. So these austerities are quite simple. Very hard to have a really nice vegetarian meal, especially if it's Krishna Prasadam or if it's something that's been cooked by a Chintarupa Mataji or something. It's very, very austere. Very hard to do. Or a beautiful cake like Rasa makes for the different festivals, you know, offers it to the Lord. Very difficult to eat that cake. It's such an austerity, Mataji, I have to tell you. So, you know, and no illicit sex. Well, you know, we don't want to have any sex outside of marriage. You know, that's really tough to do. It's not that we can't have any sex at all, but just confine it to the marriage situation, you know. So it's really tough to do. No gambling. Gee, we can't go to Crown Casino or the races anymore. Isn't that a pity? Oh, we really miss that, don't we? And we don't gamble with our lives either. We don't gamble with our lives. We don't take risks with our lives. We don't do stupid things anymore. And finally, no intoxications. Well, who'd want to actually get involved in any sort of intoxication? We've seen the results of so many people becoming intoxicated. At the moment, there's a plague of people that are on ice, this dreaded drug that's actually destroying people. There's this ad on YouTube. Has anybody seen this ad that they've produced in America? Like teaching people not to go on ice, and they show you different examples of what actually, have you seen it? Of all the different things that happen to a person if they go on ice. Well, you wouldn't want that on your worst enemy. It is outrageously shocking. You know, so we voluntarily give that up. We don't need that intoxication. Our only intoxication is the Mahaprasadam and the service of the Lord, you know? So Other religious traditions also perform austerities. You know, in my interfaith work, we learn about this. Actually, there was an interesting thing again. Just recently, as I was going through Facebook, there was this thing about this Buddhist monk. They found this Buddhist monk performing austerities, and they thought, I don't know if he's dead or not, but anyway, has anybody seen that one? There's this Buddhist monk, and he's like petrified, like in a rock form. Did you see that? And they're saying he's actually alive, he's still meditating, you know. So, and there's this whole crumpled up, you know, Baba sitting there, and he's you know, in a meditation position. So that's austerity, that's real. So these different religious organizations, they have these different austerities. When I was in the Christian tradition, they have some pretty amazing sort of austerities that they perform. There's one that they have, which is a hair shirt. Has anybody ever heard of that? A hair shirt? It's a shirt made out of like buffalo hair or something, right? So it sticks on your body and it's like continuously itchy and biting into your skin. You know how when you get something, a little bit of stuff caught in your shirt and you go, oh God, what is that, you know? Well, they put a whole shirt of hair on their body and this was their austerity. It's like you want to scratch but you can't. So this was one of the things they did. Another thing that they did, they used to like flagellation. Anybody know what flagellation is? Flagellation is whipping. So they get a kick out of that. That was an austerity as well. They would whip, you know. Again, to derive some sort of penance, perform some sort of austerity, and in their mind to actually do something in service to God. Other people put them through, themselves through, and they still do this to this very day, they put themselves through a crucifixion. So they actually nail themselves to a cross in penance to Jesus, you know, to develop their love for Jesus. They nail themselves up to a cross, and this is all in the name of religion. So this is pretty austere, that's pretty heavy stuff. But we in devotional service have much more difficult things to do, you know, like I've mentioned, all those different things that we have to give up. It's so difficult. There were other ones like St. Francis of Assisi. For his whole life he wore bare shoes. He had never wore shoes, just his bare feet on the rocks and everything, in the cold weather and everything. So it's interesting. Christian tradition also, we used to have that. And I don't know if they do this still because they cut so many things out. There was a period of time called Lent. Anybody remember Lent? Yeah? And you give up something for Lent, right? And and save it. Yeah, I used to fast from lollies, yes. Right? And so you'd say, no lollies, you know. For what was it, a month, wasn't it, Bhakti? So for a month you wouldn't eat lollies. So every time you were offered a lolly, you'd put them in the lolly jar, right? Ah, yes. And you'd save it up, and then at the end of Lent, you had this big jar of lollies, and you'd just, so much for the austerity, you know. But other people do other things. So this is really interesting. So the process of actually doing some sort of tapasya is there in all the different religions. Even in the Christian tradition, again, they've had certain apparitions, and they asked Prabhupada about these apparitions. You've heard about the apparitions of Mother Mary coming to different people, right? Medjugorje, Fatima, Lourdes, you know. So they asked Prabhupada, what is that phenomenon? And Prabhupada actually said, well, that's actually an expansion or a representation of Radharani. So she's actually, in their own way, encouraging people in devotional service. So when you go to those places, it's actually quite a moving place. A lot of devotees have actually done kirtan, especially in Croatia, in Medjugorje, they've done kirtan there. And so there's something really special there. So there's, again, a connection. And that apparition of Mother Mary simply tells, nothing more, simply tells the world or the message through the people that she's speaking through, that you please do some austerity. That penance is the only way to God. And in the Christian tradition, that is the chanting of the rosary. So she recommends the chanting of the rosary. Is that correct, Rebecca? Yeah?
She asked them also 2 days a week to eat only
dragon water. That's right. So again, that's like an austerity. So at least for 2 days a week, be a vegetarian. Try being a vegetarian. Just bread and water. So again, they're in different practices.
Sorry,
what was that?
What's an apparition?
Huh?
What's an apparition?
An apparition is a vision. There were these little Christian kids that actually had a vision of Mother Mary. And if you look it up, she manifests herself in the beautiful form of a woman. And it's hard to, you know, the Christians obviously think that it's Mother Mary, but we can understand it's either an angelic form or it could be an expansion of Radharani. That's what Prabhupada said. So that's what it is. So she... Really?
And to others she appears at least once a month, but to three children she still appears every day, 5-10 minutes, and
amazing,
the
isn't
messages.
It?
And they're really like a Bhagavatam, you know, what she says, it's really not according to the Catholic Church, but she says little bit so it doesn't come from the Pope and everyone. And she said actually she wrote, one of them, she dictated her biography, and she said it will be released when Mother Mary appears to her.
Wow.
And my mom also had visions of Mother Mary. She didn't talk to her, but she saw and she said, you have same as the one, like a deity I got from Medjugorje, because I went to Medjugorje years ago.
Mm.
And she said she looks exactly like her, like
the beast. Amazing. So, I mean, she's dressed in like a sari and it's covered the head.
And white cloth, and once she had, she was sitting and she described her dress. She had like a square and triangle on the square. And my mom said, you can't describe how beautiful she is and you can't describe the colors and the cloth. She said, this is something that you don't have the words of to say.
Absolutely amazing, huh?
So
again, in those apparitions, she is asking people to please be austere, to practice some sort of penance. So just recently, I had the opportunity this week. Everybody knows that at the moment it's Ramadan, right, in the Muslim faith. So Ramadan is also a period of time to perform austerities, to actually get close to Allah, to develop a connection with Allah, the Supreme. So I had the opportunity, the Catholic University invited me to actually attend an iftar dinner. An iftar dinner, anybody know what an iftar dinner is? And what's an iftar dinner?
Iftar is that evening day when they make the fast, so they call all their friends and
they have a dinner together. So this one was organized by the Catholic Church in the Catholic University, and they invited all the different religious leaders from all over Melbourne. And they had the commissioner for police and politicians and everybody breaks the fast at a particular time. And it has to be exactly at that time. And we're all waiting, you know, and the clock is ticking, and it was something like 6:02, something like that, I think. No, hang on, 5:02. We had to be there at 4:30. And so they're waiting and waiting. Okay, now we can eat. And so you break your fast with a date. You have a date. And so we had the iftar dinner, and I was thinking, oh, this is nice. They're trying to make advancement to serve Allah. And then they served the meal on it. And it was lamb shanks or something. Not for me. I mean, they made sure that I had some vegetarian risotto or something. But, you know, and I'm thinking, God, you're doing this tapasya. You're doing this austerity, you know. You're not fasting all day. And then you go and spoil it all by eating the bones of a dead animal. You foolish, foolish people, you know. So this is it. I mean, this is the ignorance that people are involved in, you know. And for some people, it's actually a huge austerity to follow this Ramadan, because Ramadan means you don't fast from sunrise to sunset. So we were in Europe recently, and Ramadan is also there, right? Now, the sun rises at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it sets at about 10:30 at night. So these guys have got a real lot of problem, you know. And then they also, in the Swedish countries near the Arctic, right, the day goes on for about 6 months or something. You know? Guess what? They had to make some adjustment there, you know. Well, we'll make some adjustment. So Ramadan is also there. It's for the purpose of doing some austerities to get closer to God. So the devotee must be also austere. You know, in our eating, sleeping, mating and defending, we also have to be austere. That's required on us. But actually it happens naturally, you know, because we follow a diet. In our eating, we shouldn't have rasa vilasini's cake every day. You know, we should moderate and we should be very mindful that we don't have too many exotic sort of dishes, that we have a simple meal. Must be vegetarian, of course, because that's what Krishna is telling us to have. We shouldn't sleep too much. That's a good one on these cold nights, isn't it? Huh? Shouldn't sleep too much. 4:30 rocks around, oh, another half an hour, won't work. It's okay. 5 o'clock, I'll be able to finish my rounds, you know. So, you know, but we shouldn't sleep too much. You know, Krishna consciousness, that austerity of waking up a little earlier, early in the morning, and focusing on the Supreme is a great time. You know, the Brahma Muhurta hour is the best time to actually do that. Also, our bed shouldn't be luxuriously. You know how at the moment, you know, when they make such a big deal about beds. If you see advertisements in the paper about beds, they've got like 20 cushions on the bed and fluffy doonas and this thing and that thing. It's just asleep. You know, you just fall asleep somewhere. If a devotee's really tired, they'll just roll up in the corner and fall asleep. After you've done service, you know, anything looks good, you know. Yeah. Right, that's
and we're walking around, and he said, just give me a second, and he just lied down on the concrete where they were walking. He said, just give me 10 minutes, and he just had to sleep there.
Amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Even on Sankirtan. Tell them those stories that you were told about the Sankirtan.
Oh, that was Ganga.
Yeah, Gangeshwara.
He told that story that they went up, I think it was to Burin or Poitain.
Yeah, somewhere up there.
In the middle of a storm, and they thought, well, you know, should we be driving in the storm? And everybody said, no, don't drive in the storm. They thought, well, we don't want to miss out on the day of doing Sankirtan for Krishna, so we'll go anyway. So they drove, and then they camped somewhere overnight. They put the tent up. They slept. Gangeshwara woke up in the middle of the night, and it was raining and pouring, and the tent was, you know,
half flooded.
And he was with Saraksha. And Saraksha was lying on his side, and his nose, his face was half in the water.
So you're so wiped out after Sankirtan, you'll sleep anywhere, you know. So that's Krishna makes this not so big deal. So mating, we only mate in marriage for the procreation of new life. Defending, we have minimal self-defense. We don't all go and do karate courses or anything like that. I mean, it's just not necessary. Knowing that Krishna is in control of everything. I mean, you know, Rake Krishna Marake, Mare Krishna Rakeke. You know, if Krishna wants to kill you, no one can stop him. And if Krishna wants to save you, no one can stop you. So, I mean, the point is we just surrender to Krishna. We just let it happen. You know, whatever happens is okay. So those austerities must be performed. But the austerities that the devotees perform are austerities in the mode of goodness. There are also austerities. A lot of these other austerities that I've been mentioning are in the passion and ignorance. I mean, even Hiranyakashipu performed great austerities. Right? He performed great austerities, but they were austerities in the mode of ignorance. So we have to perform our austerities in the mode of goodness. Understanding that Krishna, saying that Krishna says that austerities must be performed, but not alone. Not just austerities for austerity's sake. We have to perform devotional service. So devotional service, the process of bhakti yoga actually encompasses all these different austerities, and that's all we have to do. Very, very simple process. And with that austerity comes knowledge, and we gain knowledge about Krishna consciousness. So this is a very, very important thing. In the material world, we see that doing some austerity is good for you. We see that some austerity is good for you, even in the material world. Say, for example, if someone wants to be an expert sports person, they have to perform some austerity. If you want to go to the Olympics, you can't just up and say, well, I want to be part of the Olympic team. It really means you have to practice your craft, the sport that you're engaged in. And that takes austerity. And we see also that some of these austerities are beneficial. Like say, for example, you have a lot of problem with delinquency. Kids that are running around the streets doing graffiti and smacking things and breaking things and stuff like that. A lot of people say, well, why don't we just, you know, have conscription again to engage these people into some sort of austerity, some sort of discipline that will direct them. And in a sense, that's correct. You know, that's quite an austere thing to do, and it'll actually help them. So discipline and austerity is, to some extent, is a good thing. Working hard, you know, is a good thing for some people to have to do, because an idle mind is a devil's playground. If someone is just lolling about, there's room for them to perform sinful activities, whereas if one is engaged, then there's less chance of that coming about. So the real purpose of Krishna, of austerity, is to get to Krishna. And the Lord, as is mentioned here, is in everyone's heart. So adhokshajan is beyond the senses. So our duty is to get to know Krishna, and then Krishna reveals himself to us. That's a fact. Krishna will reveal himself. In this verse, actually, it's mentioned that the truth is realized in three ways. The first one was Jyotir. Jyotir is Krishna's effulgence, the light. Jyoti was translated as the light. So this is the Brahman effulgence. So that's one aspect of Krishna. The next part that Krishna is Bhagavatam Adhokshajam. So that is Krishna in his supreme abode, that Krishna has his own abode. So you have the sun and you have the sun's rays. So Krishna has his own abode. And the final one that's mentioned in this verse is Sarvabhuta Guvasam. And that is the Lord in the heart. So Krishna is residing within our heart. And in the human form of life, we have the opportunity, the choice, to actually either choose God or not to choose God. To choose material nature or not to choose material nature. And if we choose to serve God, that we want to get in connection with God, we have to perform some austerity. That's a must. In God's creation, we take birth in the place which we are conditioned to live in. So in this material world, we are conditioned to live in a particular place. At the moment, we're in this human form of life, which is the greatest advantage to actually perform some simple austerities and get to know Krishna. In other places, we could have a fiery body if we're born on the planet of the sun, because actually Prabhupada states that there are living entities on the sun, but their body is different to ours. Their body is of a fire. So we've got the elements, fire, earth, water, air, ether. Those, yeah, there are different living entities that are made up. We're earth living entities. Our body is made of earth. So in the sun, there are people with a sun body. So every condition, you get an opportunity. And in this human form of life, that's the best opportunity that we can get to perform some tapasya. Otherwise, you could be trapped in the body of an animal. You could be trapped in the body of a fish who lives in water. You could be trapped in the body of a microbe, and so on and so forth. In every case, whichever body you're in, whichever material body you're in, you're captured. You're captured, you're in a cage, in a prison cell. This material world is a prison. We have to be quite aware of that. And everybody thinks falsely about, you know, well, actually it's not such a bad place. But actually, it is a prison house. And recently, I was given this information about a concentration camp, actually, during World War II, Auschwitz. Anybody heard about Auschwitz and the horrors that went on in Auschwitz? Horrible place. That's where the Jewish people, homosexual people, gypsies were herded in and captured by the Nazi regime. And in there, even in such a horrible prison situation, when some of the inmates were asked after the war, how bad was it? They said, oh, it wasn't that bad. You know, we got an opportunity to do some sport, we had some opportunity to do some music, and we had some opportunity to... So this is the delusion that living entities are in, that they're captured in this material world and still they think it's okay. So we're in a cage, in a material cage. Trapped by material nature, birth after birth. It's one prison cell after another. So if you're not actually making an endeavor to go towards God consciousness, then it's one prison cell after another. We go into a different, you know, and we're forced by material nature. We're not free, but in essence, all of us want to be free. We want nothing more than to be free. We want to be liberated. It's the whole thing about society today. You know, everyone should be given freedom. But actually, there's no such thing in this material world. There's no freedom. We're actually under nature's control at every moment. If at one stage we think and we want the freedom to say, all right, I'm going to stop breathing. You can't stop breathing. Nature forces you to breathe. It's just, and this is a really good argument sometimes when you're talking to people in your preaching endeavors, when they say to you in your preaching, you know, that actually you're not in control of this human form of life, and they say, yes, I am. And they say, well, my friend, stop breathing for a moment. Let's give you 5 minutes, stop breathing. They can't do it. Stop blinking your eyes just for, let's say, 5 minutes. It can't be done. Okay, now this is a real big test. Don't go to the toilet. We won't let you go to the toilet for, let's say, 24 hours. Well, let's see how free they really are. So, you know, or we're called to go to sleep. So a material body, we're always under the strict laws of nature. So the other areas of the material world where we know that we're encaged, where we're trapped, and it's suffering, is like I notice quite often when I do chaplaincy work, and Russell knows also, we see the horrors of this material world. You know, when you're all healthy and everything's going great, you just think, yeah, I'm free as a bird, I can do what I like. But when illness strikes, and you're under this pressure of pain and suffering, it's a horrible situation. And we see this when we do our chaplaincy. And it's just like these people are suffering with no release, you know. People that suffer from cancer and they do these horrible treatments, chemotherapy and this thing and that thing. It's so painful. Not only is it painful for them, but then the people that are their close relatives, their relations, their family, they have to see this suffering. They have to see the suffering that the person is going through, and that's emotional pain. You know, that their daughter or their son is dying of an incurable disease and nothing they can do. It's a bad bargain to be in this material world. It's a really bad bargain. In every way, we're trapped and we're encaged. And still, you know, if you ask someone, you know, so what is the situation? They say, oh, she'll be right, mate. We'll be right. And the Australian ethos, you know, say, no, she's right, mate. We're going. Yeah, everything's, what do they say? Everything's right. She'll be apples. Yeah, she'll be apples, mate. She'll be right. But it's not. You're trapped, my friend. You're trapped in this material world. You're just bottled up in one cage after another. Next lifetime, it'll be a different cage, and a different cage, and a different cage. So we make the best of it, but we are trapped birth after birth. And so one prison cage to another, and then we have no freedom. Freedom is only awarded in the spiritual realm. Freedom is only awarded in the spiritual realm, and that's our true nature. We're actually not this material world, these bodies. We don't belong to this material world. We're actually like a fish out of water. We're out of our real inherited position. We are spirit. We are transcendental. We're part and parcel of Krishna, spiritual energy residing in this bag of stool, bag of blood, flesh, messy stuff, right? And we're stuck in this. So we have to break out. And there's only freedom awarded in the spiritual realm. And this is what's advocated in Krishna conscious philosophy. There are many verses in the Brahma Samhita, and I just wanted to read this out, which describe the nature and the activities of the spiritual realm, our real home. And we've all read these things, but this is like a synopsis, especially in verse 29, for example. We find that the Lord engages in many playful pastimes. He has playful pastimes. He's playing all the time. He's not an old man sitting in the high in the sky in a chair trying to manage everything while overlooking the material creation. Instead, we find that Lord Krishna is engaged in playfully tending the cows with his many friends, or engaged in dancing, having a picnic, teasing his relatives, sporting with friends in the abodes built with spiritual gems. This is Krishna. And surrounded by millions and millions of wish-fulfilling trees, he is served with great reverence and affection by thousands of goddesses of fortune. In verse 2, it states that Goloka, the supreme abode of the planet, appears like a lotus flower with thousands of petals. Life there is eternal. So there we're constantly engaged in Krishna's service. As any everything else in the spiritual world, it's eternal and it's full of bliss and knowledge. Everything is known to you. Everything is blissful. It's full of pure devotees who have unlimited facility for their loving service to the Supreme Being. So it's, you're with people, all people like Srila Prabhupada and your Guru Maharaj, just with them, as friends, as loving associates. This is your right to be with them. There are beautiful homes and gardens with ample vegetables, flowers and jewels. Each person is full with all beauty, wealth and strength. You have everything. Everything you possibly could want. Fame, knowledge, bliss, everything is there. You don't have to strive for anything. They also wear the most beautiful clothing. You were just describing that before. Clothing that we couldn't even comprehend. You know, we make such a big deal about our clothing, but in the ultimate end, it's all just drab material things dressed on a dead body. And fly in wondrous planes from spiritual planet to spiritual planet. So we just, all walking is a dance, all speech is a song, and water is nectar and the land is a touchstone. This is our heritage. This is the destination where we belong. This is what we have to do. This is our real destination, our eternal home, and this is where we really belong. And to get out of this trap condition, this disease condition, we have to undergo penance, suffering. If one has a disease, we have to undergo an austerity of some sort of surgery. Prabhupada gives the example of a boil. Has anybody had a boil when they've come back from India? You've had a boil? Oh, well, you've had a boil? Have you had a boil? They hurt like anything, especially if you get them in a part of your body where you've got to sit down a lot. Right? It's like every time they're like, oh, I've got a boil. Yes, I've got a boil. That hurts. And so the only way to actually relieve that pain is to do what? Blow on it? Not that somebody would blow on that area where I was thinking about, but blow on it? No. That could, what do you do? Doctor, tell me what you do.
Incise.
You lance it. Cut it. And that causes a little bit of pain. You can have some anesthetics, but it causes pain. So we have to do that. So tapasya sevaya. No other means. You have to lance the boil of material existence. Like, and those austerities, those sufferings, those pains, those surgeries are not so hard. They're not so difficult for devotees. Krishna and Prabhupada have made it so easy for us to perform these austerities. It's not so hard. I mean, say for example, tomorrow is Ekadasi. Oh boy, that is such an austerity, isn't it? To go without grains. Man, we have to do that twice a month. Don't know if I can manage that, you know. Every Ekadasi, Bhakti and I go, whoa, it's Ekadasi. I get buckwheat pancakes, you know, with all different jams and different stuff on it. It's like, where's the austerity? But you're performing austerity. What to speak of curd steaks offered to the Lord? Anybody had curd steaks? You have to come around to our place. We have curd steaks on Ekadasi. Absolutely lovely, you know. So this is such a big austerity. But we do it. For gaining Krishna consciousness, for getting closer to Krishna. No one in Krishna consciousness is a loser. You actually win all the way, every austerity you perform. Prabhupada, I was reading, listening to a class that Prabhupada gave, and there was this priest on a plane. And he came up to Prabhupada and he said to Prabhupada, can I just sit with you? And Prabhupada said, why not? So the priest sat next to Prabhupada and he asked a question. He said, how is it that your devotees are so bright-faced, so effulgent? How is it? And Prabhupada said it's basically because their activities are in line with Krishna consciousness and they perform genuine tapasya in the service to the Lord. So this is it. We're not denying that we have to perform some austerity, but the austerities that we do are just so wonderful and actually very pleasing. So we have to do these things. But we have to do these things right. We have to follow the instructions of Guru. Do them correctly. If you follow the method, if you follow the procedure, the result will be there. Just recently, again, I had this wonderful opportunity, and I wonder if anybody has seen it, where Shiva Ram Swami, anybody knows Shiva Ram Swami? Shivaram Swami gave this far out debate with this atheist boy. He was actually a devotee, but he put on the act of... Has anybody seen that? Oh, it's so good. So good. He's a great atheist, wasn't he? He was really putting the arguments towards Maharaj. But the conclusion was, Maharaj was saying, look, you have to at least try this. Try it for a small period of time and you will see that Krishna consciousness works. You will see, you will realize you're not this material body and you will start to appreciate Krishna. And so this is the case. You have to actually try it. You have to put yourself out and do it. So this was an amazing thing. You have to follow submissively the instructions that are given by the teacher, by the surgeon. Actually, our guru is a surgeon. He cuts the knot of attachment. Hridaya Granthi cuts it. Guru cuts it. Guru's heavy. And he'll give you these heavy austerities to perform to attain God consciousness. Really, really heavy. Don't eat meat. Don't have illicit sex. Don't gamble. Don't have intoxication. Chant 16 rounds. Wow. You know, that is so tough. Blissfully. And the result of it is that above and all these austerities, the Lord is most pleased by just your following submissively these instructions. And when you do, Krishna actually reciprocates. Krishna will reciprocate with you. You will feel Krishna within your heart. You will experience Krishna. How is it possible that devotees can be chanting for many, many years if there's no reciprocation? Krishna actually reciprocates with you. It can be just a flash. But that reciprocation keeps you going. I want more of that. When you have an inkling of Krishna's presence, when you're chanting, when you're meditating, when you've been performing these austerities, all of a sudden, just a wisp, you have a feeling of Krishna's friendship. You know how Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, I'm a friend to all. What does that really mean? In the material world, we have our friends, but there's always a possibility that friend may deceive you or leave you or, even in a marriage, you know, your life partner is your best friend. But even in this material world, your best friend will eventually leave you. One of you has to pass away. And so that's there. But Krishna will never leave you. And he loves you so much. So as we perform this austerity of Krishna consciousness, we actually start to experience him very, very subtly, but so profoundly that it changes our life, that every time we go to meditate, every time we go to chant, every time we want to perform an austerity, we do it gladly because, again, we want to capture Krishna like that. We want to have that feeling of Krishna again. And so you'll perform anything, you'll do anything to have that feeling. And Krishna is there within the deity worship also. There's no one else but Krishna in these deity forms. They're not just metal and rock. It's Krishna. Krishna manifests in these forms for us to worship him. And those of us that have done deity worship either here at the temple or at home actually have that experience of reciprocation. That is so wonderful. You want more and more of it. It's a drug. That's a real drug. Krishna's love and friendship is a real drug. You want more. And you'll do any austerity. But all we have to do is just follow these instructions of the spiritual master. And the greatest austerity that we can perform, the greatest austerity, some of the greatest, what the main thing is following the regulative principles and chanting our rounds. Following the procedure properly, as Sridharam Swami said. We have to do it diligently. That means we really have to make an effort to chant our rounds properly. It can't be a whimsical thing. We have to search for Krishna when we're chanting our rounds. We have to think, where is that lifelong friend? Where is that personality that loves me so much? I want him. Where are you, Krishna? I miss you. I want you. When we first came to Krishna consciousness, there was this song out by, what was her name? Lakshmi Shankar. Lakshmi Shankar. And it was, I am missing you, Krishna. Where are you? That should be our feeling when we chant, Krishna, where are you? I'm missing you. I love you. You love me. I know it. I can feel it. Please. You know, and Krishna loves you so dearly. So this is the performance we have to perform. But then Krishna says even the greatest austerity, he leaves it to the last chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the greatest austerity to perform. Anybody know what that is?
Preaching.
Huh? Preaching. Bingo! Exactly.
Text 69. Nacha tashman manoshesu kashchin me priya kritaman bhavita nacha me tasmat anya priyatoro bhuvi. There is no servant in this world more dear to me than he or she, nor will there ever be one more dear that actually goes out and presents this knowledge to everyone. This is the greatest thing, the greatest tapasya, the greatest austerity that we can perform, is to actually bring this knowledge to someone else. Give them the opportunity. And as we heard from the first part of this lecture, from the part that Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, that even you, a person has some receptivity to your preaching, some unenvious understanding of what you're saying, they're not lost. Krishna straight away looks after them. So we as devotees should make every endeavor in every way, shape or form, through our work, through our play, through our neighbours, through our friends, through our relatives, somehow become expert in presenting this philosophy to them so that they actually gain the benefit. Simply a moment's association with you, you're making a difference. If they are receptive, if they are unenvious of Krishna, if they are at least a little bit of a thought, gee, God may exist, and if he does exist and he does love me, that's where I should be going. Just offer that opportunity to people. So all of us are preachers, all of us are gurus, and we should all go out in every way, shape or form to actually bring people closer to Krishna. And then Krishna says, that is the most dear to me. That person that's doing that, they're the most dear to me. I'll give them. And what happens is Krishna reciprocates. You'll feel him in your heart. This is not just some propaganda. This is not just something that we as older devotees are just saying, look, you know, keep it up, you know. You actually experience it. You actually experience it. And you'll want nothing more in your life. This is all you want, forever. And then Krishna takes you back home. So it's the greatest joy to preach Krishna consciousness. You can do it unlimitedly. You'll find that the time just goes. You'll feel enthusiastic. You'll feel Krishna working through you. You'll feel your guru working through you. You'll feel the shastras working through you. It is just the most nectarian thing. It's fun. It brings happiness. And it pleases Krishna. What more could you want? This is our tapasya. Every moment in Krishna consciousness is fun. Every austerity is actually fun. Everything we do in service to Krishna is fun. Doing sankirtan is fun. Doing book distribution is fun. Doing deity worship is fun. Doing kirtan is fun. Doing harinam is fun. It's all fun. Man, who would want anything else? And then the reciprocation is that you actually feel Krishna within your heart. Krishna reveals himself. This is the treasure. We have so much to be grateful for our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada. He's given us this. Give it to everybody else. I'll stop here. Any comments or questions at all, Prabhu? Yes, Prabhu?
Especially men from the world have so much opportunity.
Everywhere.
Chaitanya Chirandas, there's Sankarshan Prabhu, so many people.
Hey, but everywhere, Prabhu. All through the world. You know, like we travel to different places, you know, and there's devotees, they're doing exactly the same thing, and they're all enthusiastic, all fired up about Krishna consciousness, all getting a taste of Krishna. And each one is getting a personal experience of the love of Krishna, Krishna's friendship. Each one, each individual, Krishna is so merciful. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Prabhu?
What you said earlier was important. That is, doing it last year in more of goodness, not in passion.
Yeah.
Because sometimes people do a lot of work in passion.
Yeah.
And they have, like, they can do it for a short time. Their health breaks down and they can't continue.
Yeah.
So I think keeping it, like, if you get up early, go to sleep at a particular time so that you have the required sleep. Not that you find it so short that you break down.
Oh, absolutely.
So
absolutely.
Doing it in a mode of goodness and in everything, in all aspects.
And, you know, I mean, you should take instruction from senior devotees. Hey, here you go again. You should take instruction from senior devotees, you know, Shiksha gurus, and they'll advise you, you know. My friend, you know, you're only sleeping 3 hours a day. You're not Prabhupada. Just sleep 7 hours a night, okay? And that way you'll be able to do the best service you can possibly do. So yeah, you're absolutely right. You have to take instruction submissively. Don't be independent. And guru is there. Diksha guru is there and Shiksha gurus are there to help you, to guide you through, to be submissive and to actually
Follow this tapashi in the right way. There we go. That's the answer. Srila Prabhupada ki. Sometimes not easy to do, it takes time. But you'll slip back into bad habits and so on and so forth, but you just have to work.